Over these next two Sunday mornings, while Ian, our minister, is in the States, I'm going to take two psalms, two well-known, familiar psalms, and preach them. This morning it's Psalm 23. Let us hear the word of our God. Psalm 23. A psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Charles Spurgeon called Psalm 23 the pearl of the Psalms. And who would disagree? Because it is a real pearl of a psalm. It's why it's the most well-known psalm in the whole Bible. Boys and girls, I'm sure if there is one psalm that you know out of the 150 psalms, it's this one. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. If you haven't heard of Psalm 23, well, your parents don't deserve their biscuit after church this morning. You can eat it instead. Because every teenager and adult here knows Psalm 23. We all learnt it at Sunday school or memorized it. We all sung it in church or we've heard it sung at a funeral. Without looking at it again in your Bibles, I'm sure you could actually recite lines to it from me. Let me read out bits and leave a blank, and I want you to fill it in. Now, don't be all reserved here this morning, okay? The Lord is my
shepherd.
I shall not
want.
He makes me lie down in
green pastures.
He leads me beside
still
waters. He restores my
soul.
He leads me in paths of
righteousness.
For his own name.
Save.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of I will fear no
evil,
for you are
with me.
Your rod and your staff, they
comfort me.
You prepare a
table
in the midst of my
enemies.
You anoint my head with
oil,
my cup
runs over.
Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the
days of my life,
and I shall live in the
house of the Lord forever.
You see, you know Psalm 23, or at least you think you know it. Psalm 23 is a well-known psalm, but it is not necessarily known well. Because being brought up with a psalm like this and being familiar with it is not the same thing as knowing it. It's a bit like talking to an old friend who you haven't seen for years. And as you talk to them over coffee, you discover something about them that you never knew. You thought you knew them, but you didn't actually know them as well as you thought. And that's a bit like Psalm 23. We're so familiar with it, but the question is, do we really know it? Let me give you a few examples of how I think we can sometimes have a superficial or a partial knowledge of Psalm 23. Just think of the scripture posters or the picture books that relate to Psalm 23. What is the dominant picture used to illustrate Psalm 23? It's a picture of tranquility, right? Sheep on rolling green hills, the sun shining through some beautiful autumn trees by a still lake. It's picture perfect tranquility. It's how people imagine Psalm 23. When Ben was born, we were given this book by a friend, The Lord is My Shepherd. And boys and girls, you know what you will not find in this book? In all the pictures? You will not find a dark valley with wild beasts in it. You won't find a battlefield with enemies on it. Why? Because we tend to associate Psalm 23 with picture-perfect tranquility. But in the psalm, there are dark valleys with wild animals and enemies on a battlefield. Or maybe it's the opposite for some of us who are older here this morning. Maybe like me, you associate this psalm with a funeral or the death of a loved one. We associate Psalm 23 more with death than with life. But only one verse out of six verses speaks of death. The rest of the psalm is all about life, not death. The majority of the psalm is about food, green grass, water, still waters, rest and security, dining in a house with perfumed oil on our heads and a glass full of wine overflowing. Psalm 23 is about life, abundant life. It's more about the happiness of life than the sadness of death. But because some of us have experienced it at a funeral or in the context of death, we tend to associate it with death rather than life. Here's another way I think that we might misunderstand the psalm. It's the most personal psalm in the whole Bible. If you just glance down at it, you can see all the my's and me's and I's. There's 17 of them in six verses. If Martin Luther said the sweetness of the gospel lies in the personal pronouns, we could say the same of this psalm. Its sweetness lies in the my's and the me's and the I's. And that would be true. The Lord is not just anyone's shepherd. He's not even our shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. It's beautifully personal. But the danger is that we then think that the psalm is about us. But the psalm's actually about him. Psalm 23 begins and ends with the Lord. And in between, he is the one who is most active. We're the ones who are passive. Only in verse 4 do we do anything. Even though I walk. That's the only thing we do in this psalm. Everything else is done by God to us or for us. So the psalm is not primarily about us, even though it's the most personal psalm in the Bible. Another way we may misunderstand it is that we think we know what a shepherd is. We hear of the green pastures and the still waters, and we picture this young, gentle, pastoral boy with ruddy cheeks, with his sheep sitting under a tree. But shepherds were strong, fighting men. When David gives his credentials to Saul for why he should be allowed to go and fight Goliath, do you remember what he says? Because I've been a shepherd. I've killed the lion and the bear. That's why I should go and fight Goliath. Shepherds were not gentle and shy. They were strong and fierce. Shepherds carried a rod as well as a staff, a club as well as a crook. The rod was carried in the shepherd's belt to beat off wild animals and kill them. The staff was used to guide the sheep along a path or to knock down olives from trees to feed them. So if we want to understand this psalm properly this morning, we have to see that God, as our shepherd, is not just a gentle pastoral shepherd. He's also a fierce fighting shepherd. But then that leads us to another problem when we read this psalm. We tend to focus on the picture of God as a shepherd, and we miss who else God is pictured as. Did you notice who else God is pictured as in this psalm, in verses 5 and 6? He's not just a shepherd, he's a host. The metaphor of shepherd and sheep in verses 1 to 4 shifts to the metaphor of host and guest in verses 5 to 6. God is as much a host in Psalm 23 as he is a shepherd. Which leads us to ask, what is the connection here between shepherd and host? Because in verse 4, we're in a valley and the shepherd is with us, and all of a sudden we're transported in verse 5 to a house and a dinner table where a host is giving us a meal. It moves seamlessly, smoothly from shepherd to host. So we need to ask, what is the connection between a shepherd and a host? Well, it was this. They had one thing in common, and that was that they were fully and absolutely responsible for those in their care. Shepherds were fully and absolutely responsible for their sheep. Hosts were fully and absolutely responsible for those in their house. This is what is at the heart of Psalm 23. It is the Lord's full and absolute responsibility for you and me. That is why this psalm brings comfort for all of life. God takes full and absolute responsibility for us. Did you notice the active, intensive language throughout the psalm? Verse 2, He makes us lie down. He doesn't invite us to lie down. He makes us lie down. He leads us beside still waters. He doesn't point us to them and say, off you go. He leads us there. In verse 3, He restores our soul. He leads us in paths of righteousness. In verse 5, He prepares a table for us. It's a language of active initiative, of strength, of leadership. It's the language of full and absolute responsibility. And Psalm 23 reveals the Lord's responsibility for us in five ways. My boys and girls, there's four on your sheet, but I came up with another one after I sent the email to Imogen. So you get a bonus point if you listen for the fifth one. Five ways that we see the Lord's responsibility for us. Number one, He provides for our needs. He provides for our needs, verses 1 to 3. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That is a statement of full provision. I shall not want. And it is as a consequence of who the Lord is. The Lord is my shepherd, therefore I shall not want. And what we do not want for is our basic needs. The green pastures relate to food. The still waters relate to drink. And the fact that He makes us lie down in green pastures means that we have more than enough food and drink. But it also means that where we lie down is safe and secure. We can actually rest there. It's a picture of satisfaction, but it's also a picture of security. Hence, verse 3, He restores my soul. Here is a shepherd who ensures the basic needs of his sheep are fully provided for. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He provides for our needs. Second, He guides us on our way. He guides us on our way. Verse 3, He leads me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. It's important here to see the connection between righteous paths and wholeness. He restores our soul, that's wholeness, and He does so along the paths of righteousness. In other words, happiness is found in holiness. Wholeness as a person is found in righteousness. And here's the great comfort for us. As our shepherd, the Lord guides us along the right paths, the paths of righteousness, in order to bring us to the place of wholeness. And He does so for His own name's sake. In verse 1 and 2, He does it for our good. In verse 3, He does it for His glory. And those two things are not mutually exclusive, because His glory is what satisfies us. It is what restores us to wholeness. So this is the way God takes responsibility for us. He provides for our needs. He guides us on our way. And third, He protects us from all evil. He protects us from all evil. Verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. It's called the valley of the shadow of death or deep darkness because valleys were where wild animals would prey on sheep. And actually, valleys were where you would find the green grass and the still waters. We mustn't think that the green pastures and the valleys are necessarily different places. And as the sheep would make their way down into a valley to find the grass and the waters to feed, that is where wild animals would be waiting for them, lurking in the tall grass, waiting for that moment to pounce on them. That's why the valley is described as a valley of the shadow of death. It's because the sheep's life could be taken. When they entered the valley, they entered the shadow of death. But it's also important to notice how we get to the valley of death, or the shadow of death. We get there from the green pastures and the still waters via the paths of righteousness. Do you see that? You get to the valley via the paths of righteousness. And since it is the Lord who leads us along such paths, it is the Lord who leads us into the valley. It's not that as sheep we wander off into a dark valley away from the shepherd in the green pastures. No, the shepherd of the green pastures leads us into the valley of the shadow of death. But rather than that terrifying us, it should actually comfort us. Because look at what David says in verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Now note the shift in person. So far God has been referred to in the third person, verses 1 to 3 and verse 6. But in verse 4 and 5, he's spoken of in the second person. David has stopped talking about God and has started talking to God. There's something wonderfully intimate here. At his most vulnerable in a dark valley among wild beasts, on a battlefield among enemies, David begins to talk to God face to face. For you are with me. And this goes to the heart of this psalm. God's responsibility for us is manifested in his presence with us. God's responsibility for us is manifested in his presence with us. And that presence is seen practically in rod and staff. Remember, the rod is a club used to kill off the wild animals. The staff was used for guidance. And this is why they comfort. Because God is with us to protect us and to guide us through the danger. God is not like a distant CEO in his head office in another country who you've never seen directing the affairs of our lives. No, he's the ever-present shepherd in the valley, who is with us in life's dangers. It's what shepherds do. They stay with their sheep. They're always with them. This is God's full and absolute responsibility for us. It manifests itself in his presence with us. And so we can say, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. I think those five words, for you are with me, summarize the whole Bible. Martin Luther said that the Psalms are a little Bible. Well, I think for you are with me is a little Bible. In Eden, God lived with Adam and Eve. On Mount Horeb, God promised Moses he would be with him in Egypt. At Mount Sinai, God came to live with Israel in a tent. In the promised land, God came to live with Israel in a temple. In Jesus Christ, God came to live with us as Emmanuel, God with us. When Jesus left the earth, he sent his Holy Spirit so that we would not be alone, so that he would be with us. And one day, in the new heavens and the new earth, God will again live with his people. It's how the Bible ends. Now, the dwelling of God is with people. For you are with me is a little Bible. It's the whole Bible in a nutshell. And that is the comfort of this psalm. That's what's at the heart of this psalm. It's about a shepherd who is with us. Now, I don't know what your valley is this morning. Singleness, loneliness, infertility, a difficult marriage, a difficult child, a difficult parent, ill health, no job, a broken relationship, sad news in the family, the loss of a loved one, sleepless nights. I don't know what your experience is, but this morning God comes to you in Psalm 23 and he says, I am with you in your valley. He led you into that valley via the paths of righteousness, and he is still in the valley with you. And that is why we can be comforted, because whatever evil is in the valley, whatever evil lurks in the dark, long grass, wanting to hurt us, the Lord is there, and he has a big club in his hand. He's not a gentle shepherd. He's a strong shepherd. And you may say, well, how do I know God is with me in the valley? Well, look again at verse 4. You see how the valley is described? It is the valley of the shadow of death. And where there is a shadow, there is always a light. Boys and girls, if you can see my hand here on the wall, you can see the shadow. See the shadow moving? The only reason you can see that shadow is because of those lights. If this was a pitch dark room and I put my hand against this wall, you wouldn't see any shadow. You can only see a shadow when there is light. And boys and girls, you might be too young at this point in your life to ever enter a dark valley. But I want you to remember this morning, that one day you may walk through a dark valley. But remember, it's only the shadow of death. Why? Because in the valley there is a light, and that light is the shepherd. It is the valley of the shadow of death. The Lord is with us in the valley to protect us. It's how he takes responsibility for us. He provides for our needs. He guides us on our way and he protects us from all evil. And fourth, he refreshes us in our battles. Verse 5. He refreshes us in our battles. You prepare a table before me. In the presence of my enemies, you anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. It's quite a shift, isn't it? We're in a dark valley with wild beasts around us. And then next thing, we're in a battlefield with enemies. But the scene is quite surreal. We're in a house at a table in the midst of a battlefield. And there is a tablecloth spread for us. And our head is anointed with oil, a custom of love and respect in the ancient Near East. And God comes and fills our cup of wine until it starts spilling over. It's a picture of refreshment, joyful refreshment in the midst of a war. Some people think this is a reference to being in church and feasting at the Lord's table in the midst of life's battles. And it certainly includes that. But it may just be a more general picture of being refreshed and satisfied by God on a daily basis in our life's battles. In your struggles, in your battles, God comes as your host to refresh you, to give you joy. He is present in the home. He's not like a hotel manager who's hidden away in his office, sending his waiters to take care of you. No, he is in the house, spreading the table. The Lord provides for our needs. He guides us on our way. He protects us from all evil. He refreshes us in our battles. And finally, here's the fifth point, boys and girls. He pursues us all the way home. He pursues us all the way home. The word follow in verse 6, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. The word follow there is a bit soft. It's really pursue. Surely goodness and mercy shall pursue me all the days of my life. Now what is pursuing David? Beasts in a valley and enemies on a battlefield. And yet what does David say is pursuing him? Goodness and mercy. But we mustn't think of goodness and mercy here as two sort of ethereal, impersonal attributes floating around in the sky, following us like two guardian angels. Charles Spurgeon said that goodness and mercy here are like two guardian angels that God sends to pursue us. It's a beautiful picture, but it's wrong. God cannot be separated from his attributes, which means that it is God who is pursuing us here. The God of goodness, the God of steadfast love, of mercy. He is the one who pursues after us. Do you notice that if he is the shepherd who is leading us, and he is the host who is pursuing us, that he goes in front of us and he comes behind us. And he pursues us in order to lead us home to the house of the Lord where we will live forever. In C.S. Lewis's The Horse and His Boy, Shasta, the little boy, has been chased along his journey by different lions and cats. Different things have scared him along. And he is near the end of his journey. He's near to where he needs to get. We pick up the story there. The thing, unless it was a person, went on beside Shasta so very quietly that Shasta began to hope he had only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly became a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. That couldn't be imagination. Anyway, he had felt the hot breath of that sigh on his chilly left hand. If the horse had been any good, or if it had known how to get any good out of the horse, he would have kicked everything on a breakaway and a wild gallop. But he knew he couldn't make that horse gallop. So Shasta went on at a walking pace, and the unseen companion walked and breathed beside him. At last he could bear it no longer. "Who are you?" he said, scarcely above a whisper. "One who has waited long to speak to you," said the thing. Its voice was now loud, but very large and deep. Are you a giant?" asked Shasta. "You might call me a giant," said the large voice, "but I am not like the creatures you call giants." "I can't see you," said Shasta, after staring very hard. Then, for an even more terrible idea had come into his head. He said, almost in a scream, You're not something dead, are you?" Once more he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face. "There," it said, "that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows." Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother and had been brought up sternly by the fisherman. And then he told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives and all their dangers in Tashban, and about his night among the tombs and how the beasts howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and the thirst of their desert journey and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Aravis. And also how very long it was since he had had anything to eat. I do not call you unfortunate, said the large voice. Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions, said Shasta. There was only one lion, said the voice. What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were two lions that first night. There was only one. He was fast afoot. How do you know? I was the lion. And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, I was the lion who forced you to join with Aravis. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so that you should reach King Lun in time. And I was the lion you do not remember, who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came to shore where a man sat, wakeful at midnight, to receive you. Aslan pursued Shasta all through his life to get him to where he needed to be. And that is what God does with us. As goodness and mercy, he pursues us all the way home. In closing, I want to look at one other aspect of this psalm that we are familiar with and we have touched on this morning, but perhaps we pass over it. Such an obvious point, I've been saying it all along. The presence of God is at the heart of this psalm. But did you notice how God manifests his presence in this psalm? As a shepherd and as a host. Two human images. Here is an Emmanuel psalm. Here is an incarnate Emmanuel psalm. Because God comes to us in this psalm in human form. Do you see that? He comes as a shepherd. He comes as a host. He comes to us incarnate in the psalm. Which means it's not hard to see where Psalm 23 leads. It leads to Jesus Christ, our shepherd host. In Mark 6, Jesus hosts a banquet in the countryside for 5,000 people. Mark tells us that he made them sit down on green grass until they were more than satisfied. Here is God, the shepherd host incarnate, feeding people in green pastures. But as the shepherd host, he did not just host banquets. He did not just make crowds sit down in green grass. He laid down his life for his sheep. He died for his guests. In John 10, Jesus describes himself as the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep in the presence of wolves. Jesus, our shepherd host, entered the deep, dark valley of death. And it was not a valley of the shadow of death. It was the valley of death. There was no shadow there because there was no light there because God was absent, not present. That's why he cried, not for you are with me, but my God, why have you forsaken me? And in that valley, Jesus did not say, my cup overflows. In that valley, he said, I thirst. He was lonely, he was thirsty, so that you and I would never have to enter a valley of pitch darkness, but only a valley of the shadow of death. He conquered death. I think that's why all valleys are only shadows of death. It's why he can restore our souls. It's why we don't need to fear any evil. It's why we really will live in the house of the Lord forever. Because Jesus Christ, our shepherd host, won for us in his life, death, resurrection, and ascension, he won for us all the benefits of Psalm 23, because he experienced Psalm 23 and worse.